Very crisis on this moment now, because the big part of the politicians here are very corrupt.
We have to leave it there. David Miranda, journalist and first LGBTQ member of the Rio City Council. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You were listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio will be broadcasting live from the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Fest, June 30th through July 4th, from noon to 10 p.m. Tune in to hear sets from Big Head Blues Club, Chris Isaac, Corey Henry and the Funk Apostles, the Pimps of Joy Time, Beaufort Katuri, and more. Again, that's a live broadcast from the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, Saturday, June 30th through July 4th, noon to 10 p.m. every day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Girl, KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 5:01 and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in the face of strong opposition, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that the vote on the health care bill was postponed, and there would be no vote until after the 4th of July recess.
Portland Police Bureau Chief Mike Marshman has responded to Mayor Ted Wheeler's questions regarding police tactics at the June 4th rallies.
And the Oregon State Legislature has passed an $8.2 billion education budget.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 28th, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has gift suggestions for America's upcoming birthday.
America's birthday is coming up. What can we get it? While it's out having a drink, we can give America's house a good cleaning, and the Senate, too, removing the cobwebs, rats, and corruption. America's democracy can barely move. Let's tune it up so it's running on all 320 million cylinders. We could pay to have America's vision checked so we can have a vision again, so we can see past people's exteriors to the beauty and strengths in each of us. Maybe America needs a clean, accurate mirror so it won't have to look for itself in the TV screen. And America needs more clothes in all the various colors and styles. We should encourage America to fulfill its creative potential, to release its thousands of personalities. Let's give America freedom for its birthday, homemade, handcrafted, full of the world's flavor freedom. For its birthday, let's give America the party we all deserve. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
It was revealed today that the FBI and the IRS are investigating the 2015 decision by the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF, to award the 2021 World Athletics Championships to Eugene, Oregon. Former IAAF President Lamine Diak, who is now under house arrest in France over corruption allegations, was at the center of the decision. In 2015, current IAAF President Lord Coe was being paid $130,000 a year as an ambassador for Nike, whose founder, Phil Knight, has close associations with the University of Oregon and with Eugene. Eugene's bid for the event was led by Vin Lanana's Tracktown USA, another organization with close links to Nike.
Portland Police Bureau Chief Mike Marshman has responded to Mayor Ted Wheeler's questions regarding police tactics. The questions came after the June 4th rallies in downtown Portland, where a Trump free speech alt-right rally prompted a response from progressive activists. With the alt-right in Terry Shrunk Plaza and the Antifa and other groups in Chapman Park, law enforcement agencies tightly controlled movement throughout the area. Although the rallies were largely peaceful for many hours, the police decided to move the Chapman Square protesters back late in the afternoon. There appeared to be little provocation, and many groups demanded answers. Wheeler questioned police policy in a number of areas, including police cooperation, private security, the decision to use riot gear, and the decision to use crowd control devices. Marshman's six-page reply is long on generalizations about standard police behavior during parades, rallies, protests, etc., but details are often sparse. Responding to the question about coordinating with Homeland Security and the alt-right's private security, Marshman provides no specifics. In answer to the question about riot gear, he claimed that officer safety was the primary consideration and there was no intent to intimidate protesters. He then went on to give the Women's March and the Pride Parade as two examples where riot gear was not used. Regarding the use of crowd control devices, the chief spent a great deal of time talking about the provocation, but very little talking about the specific tools that the police used during the confrontation. Finally, the reason giving for photographing the IDs of several hundred people was simply that it was quicker than taking the information by hand. He did not mention what justification there was for taking the information in the first place. The lengthy response is likely to do little to dispel the commonly held view that the Portland police have a bias toward violence in these situations. Since Mayor Wheeler is also the commissioner for the Portland Police Bureau, the next question is, does the mayor accept the reply as is and simply file it, or does he begin work to implement real change in the PPB?
The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry said yesterday that it had found substantial evidence of unlawful discrimination at Teen Challenge International, a Christian residential substance abuse recovery program that also operates a chain of thrift stores in the Pacific Northwest, including one on Southeast 82nd Avenue. They reached this conclusion after a year-long investigation of a complaint from former employee Michaela Herrera, who claimed she was a victim of sexual and marital status discrimination when she was fired after she told management she was pregnant and was not planning to marry the child's father. The child will now move to Bully's Administrative Prosecution Unit, which will decide whether to issue formal charges. If Teen Challenge disputes the investigation's findings, they can request a contested case hearing where both sides can argue their case.
Oregon's legislators have finally passed a funding bill for the state's public education system. The bill will now go to Governor Kate Brown's desk for signature. The $8.2 billion budget is an 11% increase over the last budget, but some districts will still see cutbacks to programs and staff layoffs, prompting many educators and community leaders to say that it is not enough. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has this report.
The Oregon House passed an education budget of $8.2 billion for the next 2 years on Tuesday, but educators say they're being shorted once again. Even legislators warn the funding amount will mean cuts for some school districts, fewer teachers, and larger class sizes. Oregon educators who have been in the field for many years say they've witnessed the diminishing returns of the state's education budget. Erica Kefauver, an instructional coach for the Hermiston School District, former teacher and mother of five, assesses what she's seen in her hometown.
Right now, I'm seeing teachers left and right leaving the profession of teaching because they don't feel like they're capable of doing the job because they're not given the tools and the resources and the capacity to do that.
State lawmakers are also dealing with a budget gap of about $1.6 billion. The education budget now heads to Governor Kate Brown's desk, and she is likely to sign it. Brown called for an education budget of $8 billion this session. Celine Buchek is a special education teacher in Central Point who works with students ages 18 to 21 transitioning into the workplace. She says her program could lose funding for transportation under budget cuts, seriously hampering opportunities for her students. She says cuts like this hurt kids.
It is cheating students out of a quality education that they might get in states where there's better funding. And it's also a big burden for teachers.
The Oregon Education Association has already filed two ballot measures for the 2018 election to address inadequate school funding. Kefauver says continued underfunding could drive a younger generation of Oregonians away from the state.
I feel like we're doing a disservice to our own citizens, our own future voters, by not allowing them to have the education that they deserve.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has hoped to complete the American Health Care Act before the Senate broke for the 4th of July recess. Polls show that Americans were overwhelmingly opposed to the bill, and the Kentucky Republican knew that it would be better to get the vote out of the way before senators returned home to face angry constituents. But that did not happen. Yesterday, in the face of strong opposition, McConnell announced that the vote has been postponed, and there will be no vote until after the summer recess. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this report.
In the face of mounting opposition from doctors, hospitals, and patient support groups, as well as from within his own Republican Party, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced yesterday that the vote on the Senate bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act would be postponed until after the senators returned from their 4th of July recess.
We're going to continue the discussions within our conference on the differences that we have, that we're continuing to try to litigate. Consequently, we will not be on the bill this week, but we're still working toward getting at least 50 people in a comfortable place.
To pass the bill, McConnell needs to get at least 50 of the 52 Republican senators to say yes, and at this point, the estimate is that he has 44 at best. Hardline conservatives feel that the bill still leaves too many of the provisions and too much of the cost of Obamacare in place, while moderates worry about the impact on the constituents in their state. In many cases, these senators are under pressure from the governors of their own states. Republican governors outnumber Democrats by more than 2-1, but many of them govern states that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare or are fighting an opioid crisis that will depend on Medicaid funding. The Republican bill replaces the open-ended version of Medicaid that currently exists and replaces it with a program of cap payments to the states based on their current levels. Republican John Kasich is the governor of Ohio, a state won by Trump and a state where Republicans have held control of the legislature for 20 of the last 25 years. Nevertheless, Kasich is a strong opponent of the American Health Care Act and made these comments to CNN's Dana Bash just 3 days ago.
I'm against it. My job, as I see my job as a governor of a state, my job is to look not just today, but in the out years at the impact it's going to have on people who need help.
On Tuesday, Kasich and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper jointly called on Senate Democrats to work across the aisle with Republicans on a complete rewrite of the health care bill. McConnell himself admitted that rescuing health care may require cooperation with the Democrats, although he was far less enthusiastic.
The status quo is simply unsustainable. It'll be dealt with in one of two ways. Either Republicans will agree and change the status quo, or the markets will continue to collapse, and we'll have to sit down with Senator Schumer. And my suspicion is that any negotiation with the Democrats would include none of the reforms that we would like to make, both on the market side and the Medicaid side.
Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York is the Senate Minority Leader. And although the Republicans' replacement for Obamacare seems to be on shaky ground, he is not taking anything for granted.
We know the fight is not over. That is for sure. We're not resting on any laurels, nor do we feel any sense yet of accomplishment, other than we are making progress because the American people are listening to our arguments.
Democrats in the Senate remember well that before finally being passed in the House of Representatives, the American Health Care Act came back from the dead so many times that it came to be known as zombie Trump care. And they also understand that as long as Mitch McConnell is still at work, they cannot rest easy. As Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal has said, quote, "The mantra on our side is never to underestimate Mitch McConnell," end quote. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Working people brought this bill to a screeching halt. We mobilized in record time, and we're not about to stand down.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka on the stalled Republican Senate health care bill. Labor isn't letting up in its campaign to stop this bill.
We're running ads. We're flooding Senate offices with phone calls. We're mobilizing in the states. We're going all out. It's time for Congress to abandon this reckless plan and come together on a bipartisan basis to improve the Affordable Care Act. That's what voters want.
Trumka says the AFL-CIO isn't fooled by what Trump and his Republicans are doing with this so-called health care bill.
Make no mistake, this bill isn't a health care plan at all. It's a massive transfer of wealth from workers to Wall Street. It obliterates Medicaid. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, it will increase the number of uninsured Americans by 22 million, and it cuts taxes for millionaires while it raises taxes on hardworking men and women who have negotiated high-quality health care. This bill is a sham, and it's a shame. So working families are fighting back. We're fighting for our children, our parents, in our community. This is a vicious, vicious assault on America's health care security.
Sandra Falwell is a D.C. registered nurse and a member of National Nurses United.
This bill poses a mortal threat to the health and well-being of our country. As registered nurses, we recognize that this is an extremely mean-spirited and callous bill that would substantially harm our patients. Instead of kicking tens of millions of people off of health insurance, we need to move forward to the only system that will guarantee that everyone has access to safe therapeutic health care, a single-payer Medicare for all.
For Zahara Heckscher, a breast cancer survivor being treated with very expensive medicines, the GOP health care bill is life-threatening.
Health insurance means that I can do the treatments that my doctors think is best, take the modern medicines that my doctors think are going to extend my life as long as possible.
Seven government employee unions oppose privatization of America's air traffic control system. Republicans in the House version of the FAA reauthorization bill included privatization. The unions, including AFGE, AFSCME, and the National Association of Government Employees, say that, quote, overhauling the entire aviation system by removing air traffic control from federal oversight and funding will be a serious setback for its development and growth. End quote. WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. Online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
In Arkansas, an unconstitutional monument on the state capitol grounds depicting the Ten Commandments was destroyed less than 24 hours after it was unveiled. The destroyer, Michael Reed, used his car, recorded a video, and posted it to Facebook. In the video, he can be heard to yell freedom just before striking. This is not the first time Reed has done this. 3 years ago, he did the same thing in Oklahoma and was subsequently diagnosed with a mental condition. Mike Huckabee quipped that this is the first time someone has broken all Ten Commandments at the same time.
What better way to impress a woman than pausing your conversation with her country's prime minister to tell her how beautiful she is? Or who knows what President Trump was thinking when he interrupted his Oval Office phone call with the new Irish prime minister, Leo Varadkar, to wave Irish reporter Katrina Perry over to his desk and praise her smile. Perry's employer, the Irish state broadcaster RTE, captioned her own video of the encounter on Facebook as evidence that she got the, quote, presidential seal of approval from Donald Trump. Perry herself referred to the encounter as a, quote, bizarre event.
As if to confirm President Trump's experience with fake news, Time magazine has asked him to remove false Time magazine covers that are on display in his golf clubs. A framed Time cover featuring Trump and the headline, Donald Trump, The Apprentice is a Television Smash, were seen hanging at Mar-a-Lago in Florida and are fake. Those images, dated March 1, 2009, had never run in the magazine in any format. The real magazine cover for that edition featured actress Kate Winslet. The forged cover was reportedly on display at four other golf clubs owned by the president.
Italy is looking to stop the flow of migrants into the country. It is estimated that 10,000 people have come from North Africa in the past 4 days. This year so far, over 73,000 people have attempted to come to Italy. Of those, around 2,000 have died or are missing and feared drowned. Most of the migrants are arriving from Libya, a gateway to Europe, from places as far as Egypt and Syria. They are fleeing violence, poverty, and persecution. Italian authorities have said the situation is unsustainable and that Italy has reached a saturation point. The legality of blocking rescue ships from coming to port is questionable. International law governs such things, and the EU Office on Migration says any changes should give humanitarian groups time to prepare.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News from the VOO at 5:45, followed by The Underground at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather here in Portland calls for a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the mid-80s. East of the Cascades, in Hood River, it will be sunny with a high of 90. Today in history, in 1997, boxer Mike Tyson bit Evander Holyfield's ear in the third round of their heavyweight rematch. Our quote of the day is from another boxer, Muhammad Ali, who said, "It isn't the mountains ahead to climb that wear you out, it's the pebble in your shoe."
Data scientist Emily Gorchinsky discovered activism by accident. Zelos Marchant spoke with Emily recently. Here's what she had to say.
All right. This is Zelos Marchant. I have in the studio Emily Gorchinsky, a data scientist who accidentally found activism through investigating the lack of quality control for voter machines. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you very much.
So, accidental activism. Do tell.
Yeah. So, this was kind of an interesting path. I've always been sort of politically active, but never anything on any sort of major scales or anything like that. And all throughout last year, I was looking for ways to bring my expertise in the tech industry into some more activist roles. And I was bored one day. The day after Thanksgiving, I had the day off. I had nothing to do. And I just started questioning what is the software like for voting machines, what's the engineering process like, and is it tested, is it quality controlled, are there federal regulations that govern how it's written? And I did a bunch of research into the problem and found that there are federal standards, but they're all voluntary and they vary state by state. And as I dug into the process of certifying voting machines, which is an optional process, I found that they don't meet what I would consider in the tech industry to be anything near good engineering practice or good engineering standards.
So by voluntary, you mean those who are creating the voter machines have the choice to go through a quality control process?
It's up to the states and sometimes the localities. One of the interesting things about voting is that there's actually no such thing as a federal election in the United States. There's no, we don't elect anybody to federal office. Everything is state level, even the president is. We vote in our state for how our electoral college members will vote for the president. So the federal government doesn't have a whole lot of authority to regulate voting machines. So it's left up to the states to decide whether they want to certify them or not, to what extent they must adhere to the guidelines that the federal government has developed. But there is no mandate. There is no requirement to say, this is how you should must build a voting machine. It's not like, you know, this is how you must build a bridge or this is how you must build a road. So it's a very interesting problem and it varies state by state.
Is there, what would you say is the percentage of states in the continental U.S. that are actually regulating their voting machines?
For full adherence to the voting machine standards, I believe there's only like 12 or 13 states that require it. There are 12 states that, I believe it's 12 states that don't require any certification at all. You could just build a machine and say, here you go, buy it. give me $100,000 per machine or whatever it is. And there's no testing requirements at all. And then the rest of the states have something in between where they maybe not, they don't have to meet all of the certification guidelines, but they have to meet part of them.
That seems like a really dangerous loophole in the world where there's a lot of security information, voter fraud, not just in the United States, but worldwide. I remember several years ago, it was all a talk that, oh my goodness, you know, these countries in South America, like they don't even know whether the votes are real because they're being hacked and, you know, and then there was, could it happen to the United States? And then there, I feel like, was several of us that were like, who were involved in data or talking with data scientists going, it's already happening and there's nothing to really stop that because there's no regulation. So do you think that's contributing to that, you know, being a bigger possibility here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. We know that some of these voting machines are being used overseas in countries like the Philippines. And there are documented issues of voting machines throwing errors and giving false counts in the Philippines. But in addition to that, there's recently in the news, there's been a lot of concern about whether the election rolls were hacked, the registration databases, and whether or not the machines were hacked. And the Intel community report acknowledges that, in particular, the Russian government did attempt to breach those machines and breach those databases, and a lot of information has been dumped. Now, the big question is, did they actually affect vote tallies? Getting into the machines is one thing, but did they actually go so far as to modify the outcome of the election by changing the votes? And that is uncertain, but the problem is we didn't do any forensic analysis. We didn't do any verification of the totals on many of those machines. So the simple fact is we don't know. Computer security experts have been looking into voting machine security for a while. In 2004, it became a big issue. It's, again, a big issue. They're definitely vulnerable. They use software that is out of date. But that's not the only vector through which, you know, somebody can do harm to these machines and affect election outcomes.
Who are the companies that are making this? You mentioned Intel. So did that indicate that they are actually designing or have a part in
When I say Intel, I mean the intelligence community. The companies that are making them, there's a few different companies. ESNS, which I believe stands for Election Systems and Services, but don't quote me on that. They're based in Omaha. They make several of the machines. And Diebold, they are now under a different name, which I cannot remember for the life of me, but they also make voting machines. There's about 4 or 5 companies that currently have certified voting machines in the United States, and there are 2 laboratories that test them for software and hardware quality.
Just 2 companies that test them for the quality.
Yeah,
which is up for debate because that's not regulated.
That's correct. Now, those software company or those testing laboratories, they are regulated in as far as what it takes to become an actual testing facility for voting machines. It's actually much harder to become a testing laboratory for voting machines than it is to become a voting machine manufacturer. And there were 3. There are now only 2 that are currently in sort of the roles as far as we can legally give you the stamp of approval for these machines. So almost everything that is done is run through them. And so they basically apply the same principles, the same testing practices to all of the machines.
Do we know who these 2 or 3 companies are that are doing the testing? Or
We do. I can't remember them off the top of my head. They have very nondescript names.
Sure.
I didn't, unfortunately, write them down. I did write up a summary of all of this, which is, I have it available online. I can make it available to you, too.
That'd be great.
That does document, like, who the testing labs are, what their policies are, and what their practices are.
That'd be great. So the next big question for Wyatt, a couple, but firstly, I mean, who's funding these companies that are regulating the basic quality of the machines, and who are the companies that are building them? Is it just that anybody, Joe Schmo, could say, I'm going to build a voting machine and start doing that? And
yeah, there are actually people that are trying to do that and trying to open source voting machines, which is very interesting. The company's doing it right now. As far as the funding, that all comes from us as taxpayers through our municipal and state taxes. Now, I believe in Oregon, it's all paper voting. I don't think there's any electronic machines in the entire state. So
not yet.
Y'all are great. but where I'm from in Virginia, we have these voting machines are electronic, and every county is allowed to choose what they want to do as far as their voting practices. So it varies county to county and sometimes precinct to precinct. And yeah, those are purchased with taxpayer dollars, and it's a for-profit operation.
So just for clarification, anybody, there's open source, which would be just anybody off the street saying, I could do that, and I'm going to build that. And then, but that would indicate then that there's a government projects where they're probably contracting with people to build these machines. And then, but both avenues are going to be tax funded by the people.
In a sense, open source development is often community funded and community contributed, where people who are engineers, software engineers, electrical engineers will effectively donate their time and their expertise, which is great. And in the technology industry, the open source movement has been a really strong force for democratizing technology and making it available. There is a huge barrier to entry. It's not like anybody can just pick up and say, I want to build a voting machine. You need to have expertise in mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. But people are passionate about this. And even if it was just possible to get an existing physical device and rewrite the software that goes on it, by open sourcing it, it makes it so that everyone can see what that software is actually doing and look for bugs and look for flaws and look for security problems. And there would be no question as to whether the votes that are coming out are actually correct.
What's the case for having an electronic voting machine that you hear as your data gathering versus something paper?
I have never heard a single compelling argument for the voting systems that we use for having an electronic voting machine.
Well, Emily Gorsinski, thank you so much for joining us on KVU. Thank you very much. This is Ellis Wells and Rashant.
Juan Ramirez is a multimedia producer and freelance journalist. He describes himself as a Mexican-born, South Central Los Angeles-raised DACA recipient. He also works at the Migrant School in Hillsboro, Oregon, and has dedicated his free time aligning himself with organizations that help the betterment of undocumented students and families. Juan is also one of the co-founders of the Racist Sandwich podcast, a podcast that delves into the topics of racism, food, identity, equity, and the arts. This fall, he will also be one of the speakers at Affect Conference in Portland that hosts 2 days of talks about work, culture, and the design of social change. KBOO's Zelis Marchant spoke with Juan to find out more.
I'm Zelis Marchant. I have in the studio Juan Ramirez from the Racist Sandwich podcast. He's also a freelance journalist and works with the Migrant Education Program in the Hillsboro School District. Thank you very much for taking time and joining us on KBOO.
Thank you for the invite.
Of course. There's a series of hot topics that will probably never go away in our lifetimes. Race. What about it?
You know, it's interesting that race is a subject that is really, really rooted in the American history. This year, the past two main stories out of Oregon, Portland, have been about racism, whether it's microaggression or blatantly, you know, death. So race will always be part of our society.
It is indeed the history of America.
Yes.
You can't tell everybody that it's great here and then everybody comes and then expect everybody to leave.
It was great for a small percentage of the population.
I've often thought it's like throwing a party, you know, like a really big party. Everybody come, and then you're like, wait a minute. This is too many people. I'm like, well, you just doesn't work that way. Only it's more complex with America because heinous things were done.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Party goers that arrived.
Yeah.
Some of them by force.
Everybody's invited except the ones that wear glasses or shorts, you know, just excluding people. And then just at the end, having a small percentage of the folks. So, you know, I mean, it comes down to class as well. You know, so even if you are a white hetero male, if you are in the lower class, you're not invited to the party. Although you still can, you know.
on the Racist Sandwich podcast, how does your team curate the guests on there? They're fabulous guests with such deep introspective through lines on subjects like, you know, race and food, arts and culture. So how
class
do you
and gender? Yeah. So you know, I am very lucky to be working with two very talented folks. Soleil Ho, she is a writer and chef based out of Mexico, Puerto Vallarta. Sahir, he's an awesome journalist. You know, very, very talented folks who have been already involved for a while. From what my understanding is, you know, they keep up with current, you know, writers, and you know, they've had the background too as well. I love the fact that Soleil, as a chef, you know, can speak on things that for Sahir, who doesn't have that experience, cannot, and you know, vice versa too. And you know, what I bring to the podcast is just a little bit of my knowledge on some of the issues that I know of, and also obviously the audio.
Okay, so I get that they have like a broad range of, like, they're just in it. Each of you are just we're living it, you know? So how do you throw around ideas, though? Because race is such a hot button topic and so complex while also not being complex.
Right.
That curating something geared around, you know, all of these things, you have to find a really specific through line each time. So how do you do that?
We make a pretty good team, I believe. Soleil being a woman and a descendant of refugees, Sahir being a Muslim, and myself being an immigrant, you know, we all have different perspectives and we see the world differently, you know. We Skype call, you know, once every week or once every 2 weeks, and, you know, we just come up with ideas on how we should tackle a certain subject, how we should, you know, create a certain conversation around certain things, you know, and what we should stay away from. Because, you know, we don't want to put more wood in some things that are already flamed up. What we want to do is we want to talk about the problems instead of, or we want to bring light to the problems instead of just creating more and, you know, throwing shade. You know.
So you're presenting at Effect Comp this fall, I hear. Is what you're going to present something along the lines of dissecting race as it pertains to arts and culture and food, or?
Yeah, well, so I will be speaking of my experience. I am an immigrant. I came to the U.S. when I was 10 years old. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, which is now known as South Los Angeles. So, you know, I will be speaking about my experience and what I went through in case of, in how I lived and fed myself, what my family fed us, right? Mm-hmm. We'll be talking about a certain subject called food desert, you know, which is a touchy subject for some. In Los Angeles, the area where I'm from, it's a huge problem. And it's a low community, which happens to be a community of color. African American and Latinx, you know, folks live, you know, the area that I'm from. And so there's so many fast foods around an area, 2 mile radius, and you would probably not find one grocery store or supermarket for people to buy food. I'm speaking of my experiences, and I currently live in the outskirts of Portland, so I cannot talk or say much about what's lived in northeast or, you know, northwest Portland. You know, I cannot speak of those experiences, but I'm pretty sure they're similar from what I've heard and
what you've gathered
and gathered. Yeah, exactly. So so yeah, I mean, that's sort of like what I will tie in with food, immigration and basically racism.
Food deserts are such a real thing. A couple months ago, we had Imperfect Produce on the news, and they're a great company that has started outside the Bay Area and are just now coming to Portland. But their whole mission is to get food to these food deserts. And from that, a lot of listeners, you know, and people here at KBOO went, we didn't even know, you know. I think people drive through these neighborhoods, not just here in Oregon, but in Cali, and they never think about it. They just see the beautiful advertising or the fast track to food if you're in a hurry. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, it's like, have you seen a grocery store? I remember, you know, we live, you know, out near where you were saying, you know, out in the outskirts of Portland. And there are still, I mean, not as bad because our city blocks are smaller. But, you know, I had to point it out to my partner one day, and like, you know, who had come from inner Portland their whole lives. And I was like, do you notice anything? And he's like, no. I said, where's the grocery store?
Yeah.
You know, on TV Highway.
Yeah.
And he was like, I never thought about that. I'm like, right. But there's a lot of people of color out here, isn't there? Especially now. I mean, it wasn't always that way, but you know, these basic access to food is so important, and yet, you know, that's a luxury, the access to it in general.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you think about that, and you put that into perspective into how certain people, you know, don't have the access to just food. I mean, one of the richest countries in the world don't have access to healthy food, right? Yet, I work with the migrant education program as well. And that means that I speak with migrant workers, agricultural workers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the folks that own the land, the landowners and farm owners. And there's so much food this past year that went to waste.
Mm-hmm.
One, due to the weather. And then two, due to immigration,
mm-hmm.
not a lot of people want to come to work. And a lot of people say, well, you know, immigrants are taking the jobs. There was a lot of work this past, you know, few months. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work now. They need a lot of like labor. A lot of people did not migrate or showed up to Oregon, to the farms because of immigration. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of job openings out there.
Mm-hmm.
if, you know, if anybody wants to work in the fields, it's not the best. You're working under the sun, you're picking berries, you're picking, you know, on your knees or hunched down all the time, the whole day. So you know, that's another thing too that we often forget to talk about. I mean, for me, I grew up in the city, so I always thought of like, well, you know, urban, you know, food deserts and the urban mentality of like, all right, things are not happening here in the city. But then now that I live out in the rural area and I'm experiencing a different, you know, struggle, where it's like, you know, all these folks that work with, you know, for a pretty low minimum wage are working harsh conditions, mm-hmm. right? And they are the ones that are getting harassed by most of the world. I mean, most of the right wing USA, which is like, hey, listen, like these are the people that bring food to your Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that bring food to Whole Foods. Like,
literally, they're feeding you.
Yeah,
And
this is how they are getting treated. So,
what would you like as we wrap up the attendees that are going to see you at EffectConf this fall? Take away from that. What would you like them? If there was one or two grains of wisdom that they could pull away from your talk, what would it be?
First of all, to be mindful of where, and you know, a lot of the folks that attend certain conference already have this mindset of like, hey, look, I'm pretty aware of what things are happening, but I really hope to reach out to the ones that don't have that mindset to let them know that, hey, look, be mindful of where your food comes from, how you are giving that food and why that food is at your table and why you have that privilege of even having food at that table and that quality of food.
Mm-hmm. Just requires actually thinking about something. Well, Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
So people can sign up for Effect Conference at effectconf.com. That's right. AffectConf.com.
Awesome.
Sign up, and you know, there's going to be a lot of speakers there. There's going to be a lot of pretty good conversation starters. Folks who think differently should be the ones that should sign up to this conference and just listen,
open mind,
and listen to the conversations, because there's going to be a lot of real good conversations.
Juan Ramirez from the Racist Sandwich podcast, freelance journalist, also working with the Migrant Education Program in Hillsborough School District. Thank you again. I'm Zella Zales Marchant for KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you covered a local event and have audio or video that you want to share with the KBOO audience, we want to hear from you, too. Call us at 503-231-8032 or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Jim Thompson, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Special thanks to Oregon News Service. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. Podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, you'll hear progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia features headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Pulitzer Prize winner Gregory Pardlow about his book Digest, which draws from the present and the past to form an intellectual American identity. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.